Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the first day of a whole new month of June. Julie Mason is with us this hour as we have our All Things Political, which we always have on Monday. We have a lot to talk about: the economy, GM declaring bankruptcy, Sotomayor, Judge Sotomayor making the rounds on Capitol Hill, and more. The economy. We'll start with that. Julie Mason is now the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. She covered national politics in the White House for the Houston Chronicle for a number of years and worked as the newspaper's national political correspondent based in the Washington Bureau and covered John Kerry's 2004 presidential campaign. She's also a political analyst for MSNBC, has appeared on the Today Show, Nightly News, CNN, NPR, CBS, and Nightline. And our phone number for you to join All Things Political this hour is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Should you care to send us an email, you can do that as well, and that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Julie, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's so great to be back, Kathleen.
And so nice to have you here again. Well, you wrote a big piece yesterday on the economy, saying that Obama can characterize the nation's economic crisis as a legacy that he inherited, but that becomes his problem depending on how quickly the economy rebounds. Is it rebounding? Do you know?
Well, it's really not. What we're seeing is that the recession has slowed, but there's no growth yet. What's changing is the White House message on the economy. For months, they've been saying it's terrible, it's going to get worse. And now they're saying that we've come back from the brink and we've turned a corner. So it's interesting to watch their message sort of shift. It's gone back and forth a few times. But now, lately, they're sounding a lot more optimistic about it.
Mm-hmm. And that's just a pipe dream, do you think? Or is it indeed making some kind of change? It's hard to see.
Well, I think it's a little premature. The president right now is trying to sell his budget plan, which is predicated on a very rosy economic forecast. He's saying, you know, we're not going to have to raise taxes very badly. We're not going to have to. It's not going to be as bad as you think because the economy's getting better. And so he needs to convince the public of this and Congress of this in order to get his budget through. So that's what I think is a lot behind this new message from the White House, trying to convince people it's getting better so that they'll go along with his budget plan. But I think they also can back it up with a few economic indicators that are going their way. But it's very far from the growth projections that the White House is putting out.
What about the unemployment numbers? In some states, it's as high as 10%.
Oh, I know. It's terrible.
It's really high, isn't it, Julie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. The jobless rate is not great. New submissions for unemployment, that seems to have leveled off, but there are still so many people without jobs. People aren't finding jobs. Fewer people are losing their jobs, but people aren't getting hired, and that's a big problem for the White House. President Obama has said, judge my programs by my success in getting people back to work, in finding jobs for people. So far, they claim they have saved or created 150,000 new jobs. That's really hard to quantify, but they're saying that they're having some success already.
Mm-hmm. But 150,000 is nowhere near the number that he wanted when he indicated how many jobs he wanted to have created.
Right, right. And they're saying in the next 100 days of the administration, they expect to save or create 600,000 jobs. So, you know, he's hoping in a couple years to have saved or created more than 2 million. Saved or created is sort of, you know, it's kind of a squishy way to say it, but in this economy, when you're talking about saving people's jobs, that still has some power too.
Right. Do you see indications that this stimulus money is already at work building roads and repairing the infrastructure? I don't see a lot of signs that's happening, is it?
I know.
Yeah.
Well, they're spending a lot of money, but you know, these projects take so long to get up and running because they have to have bids and whatnot, and governments tend to be a little bit slow in spending money. They go at their own pace. So the White House is saying give it time. They are claiming some success. They're saying the money's going out. It's being spent where we want it to be spent. But I think it's going to take some time before we see some results from this huge economic stimulus package.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk. We have a lot to talk about. Let's talk about Judge Sonia Sotomayor, who's going to be making her case in person over the week. It seems to me as though she's going to be confirmed, but not without some pretty strong comments from the conservative part of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting is conservatives, Republicans in the Senate, who are really the key players in this, the most they can do and what they're indicating they're going to do is just slow this whole train down, and they're just going to slow walk her through the confirmation process. They refuse to be rushed. And that's really the most they can do with the numbers they have in the Senate. So they're not going to be rushed on this. The parties making the biggest noise are the conservative sort of action groups. The advocacy groups here in town and around the country are very vocal. They're very much against her. The White House is describing their efforts as just a fundraising ploy. And that's their sort of message. That's their talking point on this, is that those people are just trying to raise money off the back of this nomination, so pay them no mind. So that's kind of an interesting debate. But it's, yeah, she'll get confirmed unless something dramatic happens in the interim. But if it goes as we believe, it's just going to end how we believe, with her on the court and the court not really changing very much.
Mm-hmm. Not changing very much, not because it'll be a similar kind of makeup.
Exactly. Yeah. The dynamic of the court won't change very much.
Well, what do you think, in an attempt to court the Hispanic voters, both Republicans and the Democrats would like to say the Hispanic population is voting their way. What do you make of people like Rush Limbaugh, who's become, you know, sort of a head of the party here, and others saying that this woman is a racist? Does that serve them well or
not? It's terrible. Hispanics are the largest minority in this country right now, and they're growing. And Republicans cannot afford to alienate them, especially after the immigration debate of a couple years ago. That created some very bad feelings. And if you recall, President Bush was terrific in trying to recruit Hispanic voters, and he did better than most other Republican candidates. He had a very good record with Hispanic voters, and Hispanic voters liked him. And there's no one to take his place. There's no one to take up that voice, that particular role in the Republican Party. So you see them all over the place. You're further alienating Hispanics, calling Sonia Sotomayor, calling her a racist.
Right.
And that just doesn't help the party as it's trying to rebuild.
Mm-hmm. Immigration reform. It makes me think of immigration reform. Do you think that this is going to be taken up in any substantial way soon?
No, I don't. President Obama, during his campaign, promised the League of United Latin American Citizens that he would make it a priority of his first year in office. This came up recently at the president's 100 days press conference. He was asked, "Are you still going to follow through with that?" And his answer was, "I got too much going on. You know, we're going to have to put this off. We're going to start looking at it. We're going to start talking about it." But it, you know, he basically indicated it's not going to be a priority of his first year, as he promised. And without him pushing it, it's got nowhere to go here in Washington. And they have so much going on that's a fight the White House does not want to take right now.
Mm-hmm. They do have so much going on, Julie, don't they?
It's crazy just trying to keep track of everything they have going on. And now the president is going away for almost a week. He'll be out of the country. So it's just that he's got so many balls in the air domestically and abroad.
Mm-hmm. Where is he going? Is he going to Egypt? Is it this week already?
Yes. He leaves tomorrow. His first stop is in Saudi Arabia, where he's going to be talking to officials there about Middle East peace and Iranian nukes. And then he's off to Cairo for his major speech in a Muslim country. And then he's going to Normandy, and he's going to visit the Buchenwald concentration camp in Germany.
Hmm. And tell me about the significance of that speech in Egypt that he's giving to the Muslim world. This is a big thing, huh?
It's very significant. This is something that he promised during his campaign as well, to mend ties with the Muslim world, to restore that relationship, repair it, make it better after the war on terrorism. And we saw a preview of that when he was in Turkey recently, and he declared, you know, the U.S. is not at war with Islam. And I think he'll be expounding on these themes some more in Cairo, not really talking about Middle East peace so much, because that's a point of conflict. He wants to get away from that. He wants to talk about what we have in common, our shared goals, how we must stand together to repudiate extremism. And those are the things he's going to talk about. And that's going to be a very closely watched speech. He's only going to be in Cairo for a few hours, not even a whole, he's not staying overnight. He's there for about 8 hours, and then he's out.
Hmm. Do you get to go on the trip?
No, darn. I'm not going on this one. I went on the last one, and it was quite a thing to behold when Obama went to Buckingham Palace and whatnot.
Yeah.
Do you
think the Queen was snubbed for the D-Day?
No.
No, you don't.
I think she was charmed by them.
Yeah.
by not being invited.
Right.
Yeah, the Normandy. Yeah, she seems to have really been snubbed. I suspect that in the interim they're going to figure something out on that.
Yeah, I would think so too. I think they better hurry up and do that. Don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, this guy gets around. It's just amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something all the time. We're going to welcome phone calls for Julie. It's All Things Political, which we always have on Monday. We've just touched on a few topics. Feel free to bring others. We have yet to talk about GM and their bankruptcy and what that means for the U.S. economy, for the U.S. auto industry, et cetera. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And you can always send an email if you would choose to do that or if you can't get through. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And we start our calls with Scott from Oshkosh. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Yeah. In regard, just two quick things. In regards to the economy, I mean, you had heard during the budget battle and everything about, and the stimulus battle, about all the quote-unquote shovel-ready jobs that are out there, just ready to. And it sounds like they don't exist anymore, that there are no shovel-ready jobs, even though we were told there were going to be a lot of them. That's my first point. And then my second point is regarding Sotomayor. You hear in the press a lot how the Republicans are going to pay for it if they block or obstruct her confirmation process. Why didn't the press hammer the Democrats when they blocked Miguel Estrada for 2 years? They filibustered him, which is the first time in that type of position. Why is it that it's so bad if the Republicans do it to Sotomayor, but there really was never a mention of it? There was nothing to pay for it, and the Democrats blocked Miguel Estrada, especially with the Durbin memo, who said, we got to do this because we don't want Republicans to have a Hispanic, for goodness sake, on the court.
Okay, our phone line's a little bad here, Scott, but did you hear all of that, Julie?
I only vaguely remember the Estrada debate. I've written about it, but, God, it's lost in the vault.
I know the feeling.
every time with these judicial nominations, it is such a battle. And, you know, actually, I haven't really heard the press saying that Republicans will pay. I think that the Democrats are saying that Republicans will pay. I'm not sure how they'll pay or what they'll pay because their numbers are diminished and there's not really much you can take away from them at this point. I think it wouldn't help them if they blocked this nomination, if they succeeded in really filibustering and trying to make it go down. I'm not even sure that they would risk that or they even want to bother trying to do that. But it was certainly true during the Bush administration that Democrats held up a lot of his judicial nominations for, in some cases, very specious reasons, because some senator didn't get his question answered about an unrelated topic, and we saw some judicial nominations get held up. And these are the games that Congress plays, and it just depends who's in power and who's got the power and how they wield it. And this is a pendulum we see swing back and forth in Washington. On the economy, on the question of the stimulus, there are I would say that there are shovel-ready projects, and you have to think in terms of the totality of the country, the whole country. And you can track it a little bit on the recovery.gov website that the White House has put up, which I don't think is terrific. I think it's just one big press release, but they do have examples of where the money is being spent, and you can track it. Of course, according to them, it's all a huge smashing success, so you have to really regard it with a grain of salt, but you can get a sense of where the money is going in very specific cases.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to Sotomayor for a moment. Where is she likely to be grilled this week? Is it on that wise Latina woman statement, or mm-hmm. are people concerned about guns or abortion or what?
Going to be all of that, and these senators, especially the Republicans and even the Democrats, because Democrats want to be sure that they're backing the right horse. You know, they don't want any surprises. So their questioning is going to be very close to when she's making these rounds. The wise Latina, the White House over the weekend and late last week really changed their message on that, too. At first, they'd been like, well, you know, you have to take it in context. You know, they try to sort of blow it off a little bit. But then over the weekend, the president said, yeah, she probably could have picked her words better. And then we heard the same thing from spokesman Robert Gibbs. So they're trying to neutralize that by admitting that it wasn't so great. I don't know if it goes away or not. That seems to be more of a talking point of talk radio rather than Congress. It seems to me the Senate is more concerned about her judicial philosophy, some of her past rulings, what kind of judge she's going to be.
Yes. And do you think that we as a people should know where she stands on gun rights, on abortion, et cetera, particularly considering what happened over the weekend?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I think we have a right to know. We really do. And that's not to say, you know, I think she could hold a position and rule differently on a different case. I don't think that her... And I think we see this in the other justices. They can simultaneously hold a view and also very very fairly interpret the law without bringing their personal views to bear in each and every case. I think that's one of the things that they look for, this sort of independent thought in judges. Mm-hmm. When presidents consider who they're going to put up there. And the White House has been very careful to say that, you know, he didn't talk to her about abortion. Well, the president probably didn't have to talk to her about abortion. He probably knows where she stands on that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think these senators will be bringing it up and asking her about it. It'll be interesting to see how she dodges.
Right. And do you think that she was a really good choice? What do you think went into this choice?
A lot of things went into this choice. I think the president liked her a whole lot. You know, he's a constitutional law professor, so you know, when he questioned his finalists for the job, it was really in some depth and some detail. He liked her a lot. It's a terrific political advantage for the White House. He got Republicans right in a corner on this one because she's a woman, because she's Latina, because, you know, it was going to be hard for them to fight this nomination, and so it had a lot of advantages. She also has pretty good credentials, so it was a strong choice for the White House, and one that they'll probably succeed in.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing, isn't it, Julie, that you can have this long period of time in your profession, and you say something, and mm-hmm. by golly, there it is, and we have heard that comment over and over and over and over after all these years on the bench.
Right, and it just goes to show, like, how much there really isn't out there on her. You know, if this is what we're talking right. about and talking about, they mustn't have very much ammunition to go against her, and I think that's something that the White House was really banking on.
Julie Mason is our guest for All Things Political this Monday, the 1st of June. She is White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. We're talking about the last week in politics and what's coming up this week with the president's, I forgot it was tomorrow he's leaving for another big trip, international trip, giving a major address to the Muslim world. What do you think about that? What do you think about GM declaring bankruptcy? What about the stimulus? Do you see signs that the economy has taken some kind of turnaround here? And, of course, another big story of the week is Judge Sotomayor, who will be on Capitol Hill and being grilled on Capitol Hill as well. So join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, D-Day anniversary is coming up this week, and we're going to be talking about a very special program that's taking place all over the country where veterans, particularly veterans from World War II who are getting up there in age, are being flown to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial. We're going to be talking about that and speak with a World War II vet and somebody from here in Wisconsin from the Stars and Stripes Honor Flight, which is based in Port Washington. They have a long waiting list, so they're looking for some corporate angels, and we'll talk about the program and the significance of these veterans. Hour two. Two phone calls, more phone calls for Julie. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Jim is our next caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. It's interesting to me that part of the way that conservatives are framing this debate on the Supreme Court nomination is that now white men will never they won't have any place anymore and nobody will pay any attention to them. Well, maybe based on behavior, white men deserve some criticism and deserve to be put on the back burner because of the decisions they've been made. And I just wanted to draw an analogy to this with a little tongue-in-cheek finish. That it's interesting to me that when they come up with the allegedly liberal media comes up with the conspiracy theories, they never associate the conspiracy theory with the perpetrators of crimes. They only associate the conspiracy theories with the people that confront the perpetrators. And look at some of the whack job conspiracy theories that white men have come up with in the past. Ronald Reagan, the Nicaraguans are going to march all the way to the Texas border, and saying that the students in Grenada were threatened when their safety was assured before it ever happened, and weapons of mass destruction, and of course Saddam being linked with Al Qaeda. All of these were whack job conspiracy theories. So I thought I just for the fun of it just add one more that we can come up with to justify another silly war through white men. And I just would point out to people that the Canadians have a number of valuable resources that we could use, oil, shale, gold, many other resources, and two proven facts that people can't refute. First is that black bears are known to poop in the woods in Wisconsin. and secondly, Canadians at various times have been observed near the American border. So if we don't set up a strong military task force to take over the Canadians and their resources...
the threat from the north. It must be confronted.
You can predict that the Canadians and the black bears are pooping all over Wisconsin.
You heard it here first. The next justification for war.
Oh, man, you won't hear that anywhere else either. Oh, that's funny. Thanks very much for the call. On a serious note, every now and then we get these waves of white males because of what's been happening with affirmative action, et cetera, have been put upon. I mean, is that going to be sort of an underlying thrust of these confirmation hearings, that there is concern about white guys now, that white women and minorities are taking their spots?
White male anxiety, the white male
displacement. White male anxiety, right.
Yeah, I'm not sure it really has a place in political discourse, though. It's hard to justify. You know, if they are feeling that, they'll find other reasons to object. You know, they'll justify it another way, but it does seem to be a bit of subtext to the debate, and it's tough on Republicans because what's really hurting their party is this perception that they are the white male Republican Party. They've lost the support of women and minorities in recent elections. So, if the party's going to rebuild, they really need to get away from that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jim, very much for your entertaining call. Let's go. Is it Hilda from Preston, Minnesota? Hi, Hilda.
Yes. Good morning.
Hi.
I would like to comment on the comment made by the elected Supreme Judge. The name I have a problem pronouncing, I'm sorry. But we are all a product of our environment. And I've just come back from the Deep South, from Louisiana, which of course is, the Deep South is primarily Republican. And the attitude toward democracy, toward women, is not politically correct. What she said was not politically correct, and it has been taken out of context, that a Latino woman would have a better grasp and understanding of, I don't know exactly how she said it, the everyday situation than a white male. And I happen to totally agree with her, because most white males in power are coming from a privileged background, and she did not. And therefore, someone from a non-privileged background, who now, of course, is in the privileged category, but considering where she's come from, I have totally agreed with her. I'm sorry. And I'm an independent.
Julie, you want to respond?
Yeah, no need to be sorry. I think what she said really struck a lot of people, because the point she was making was that we all bring our experience to bear on the decisions we make and how we view situations. And I think that was her larger point, that has sort of been seized upon and twisted around a little bit. But sure, I think a lot of people agree with you that she was making a strong point.
Mm-hmm. And then you can take issue with that. I mean, part of that decision, too, which just doesn't get as much play, is that white men, you know, decided Brown v. Board of Education, that white men were enlightened on issues of race. And then she didn't say this, but you can look at it, someone who had probably a poorer background than she did, which is Clarence Thomas, and he's on a different side of the issues. So there are exceptions, right?
Right. Sure. Sure. And, you know, it's interesting coming up when she does go before the Judiciary Committee, the senator who's going to be in charge of basically interrogating or talking to her is John Cornyn from Texas. And he's from San Antonio, which is a majority Hispanic city. And he comes from a very sort of strong Hispanic community. And I don't think he's going to make a lot of mistakes in questioning her. I don't think he's going to slip up or say anything untoward, and I think his selection was very deliberate in that. I mean, he's a white guy, a Republican, but he does have a real sensitivity to Hispanic issues and sort of the language that should be used this sensitively in questioning people about their views. So
mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah. Our number, 800-486-8655. I'm just interested in some of your observations about covering this administration, Julie. Are you having a good time? Is it a rapid pace every day?
It really is a rapid pace every day. The Obama administration is still really in campaign mode, where they take a long view, but the way they sort of schedule themselves and schedule the president considers only winning the day's news cycle. You saw him, for example, the timing of the Sotomayor announcement achieved two things. One, it got the North Korea nuclear launch off the front page, because that was something they didn't want to deal with right away. So that just took that issue right off the table. It also took advantage of the absence of Congress. Congress was on recess when the president announced his nominee, so they were unable to rush to the television cameras because they were blown to the four winds. They were gone. They were out of town, and they were back in their home districts or overseas or whatever. And so he really was able to dominate the news cycle without really any interference. I mean, there were Republicans coming forward, but not in the mass they would have been if Congress had been in session, if everyone had been here in Washington. So you see them sort of making these calculated decisions, and it's very, very much like a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have to say, in terms of the rhythms of the White House and the amount of information we get and the sort of, you know, this question about transparency, it's very much like covering the Bush administration. They are a very well-disciplined message machine, and there's not a lot of transparency.
Mm-hmm. And it's all, things are orchestrated, aren't they? But we seem to be hungry for information about the Saturday night date and going to a Broadway show, and all of that, I'm sure, is very well planned, but it seems to touch us, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does. The president still has very high personal approval ratings. People like him, and they like his family. And I have to tell you, being around the White House and with those two little girls, we don't see them much, but when we do, kind of gives you a bit of a mental lift just to have, like, young kids living at the White House. You know, they have a big swing set on the South Lawn, and we all sort of look at it and wish we could go play on it some days because it would just be a nice break. But, of course, you know, we're not allowed. But it's nice, and it's just sort of mentally uplifting. And that's not a partisan thing. I would say if it was a Republican family with two little kids, it would be the same sort of psychological effect. People are very interested in what they're up to and what they're doing. And that helps him politically as well.
Yeah. It's time to bring up the puppy again, don't you think?
Yeah, we need more puppy. We need to see how his training is coming along.
Exactly. I agree. Thanks very much, Hilda, for the call. Peter, related question on transparency from Stoughton. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. During the campaign, Obama spent a lot of time talking about increasing the transparency of the White House and its operations. Pardon me?
No, go ahead.
Oh, I'm hearing another voice in the background. All right. And I see it as not having changed much since the Bush administration. I can understand that there are a lot of other things that people on the left would like to see done that aren't being done out of political expediency or reality, but I don't understand why the Obama administration still seems to be stuck in the Bush mode in so many ways. I was wondering if your guest could comment.
Yeah, that's a really astute observation. That's something that we note and talk about all the time in covering the Obama administration. And I think what you're referring to most recently is his decision against releasing those detainee photos. He had promised to release the latest round of detainee abuse photos. He was lobbied by the military, his military generals, who told him, please don't do this. This will be a terrible thing. And he agreed with them, which was also a Bush policy. And he also is preserving some secrecy. And if we were giving him the benefit of the doubt, we could say, well, when you campaign, you can make all kinds of promises. But then when you're in the White House and you're getting these terrifying security briefings every day, and you are finally privy to the threats the nations face and sort of a more realistic picture of what's going on, your decision-making changes. But that's also not what he promised. He promised transparency, accountability, and they've really come up short on that. They really have, and I think they've really angered their liberal base very much, who really expected, for example, some of these voices in the Bush administration who authorized what we now regard as torture. They wanted to see those people brought up on charges, and they want Cheney brought up on charges, and the Obama administration's reluctance to really get into much detail on that has frustrated people. From a press perspective, it's frustrating because this administration does rely on background briefings, anonymous sourcing, message discipline, and a real opacity in decision making. We don't know how decisions are reached in this administration, and from my perspective, from a journalist's perspective, they have not lived up to their promises on transparency at all.
Well, that's interesting. And what do you want to know about how decisions are made?
Who's in the room? What were the options that were discussed? What factors went into making a decision? For example, on the Sotomayor thing, who else was considered? What don't just give us empathy as a criteria. What specifically? What factored into decision making on 1 year to close Guantanamo Bay? Is 1 year arbitrary? Was there some decision? Why 1 year and et cetera?
Right.
Now, they'll never tell you those things. They just want to give you the decision, the final decision packaged with a bow around it, and not tell you how it was put together.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Peter. Let's go to Zach from Sheboygan next. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you today?
Fine, Zach. How are you?
Very well. I guess my comment is, it's just a comment about how Obama is going to be is the exact opposite of what Bush was, and that's why we elected him. So for him to change his mind on the detainee photos is the opposite of what Bush would do, because if Bush said he'd do something, whether it was right or wrong, he would have done it no matter what, because he said he was going to do it. Obama got informed information or information from reliable sources. He took that information and changed his decision based on that reliable information from the generals. And I just think that that's the difference in Obama and Bush, that he will change his mind when he sees fit, and he will listen to both sides as opposed to Bush, who wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. That's a really perceptive observation about the two of them and how they approach leadership. Yeah, Bush would never apologize. He never backed down from a decision. He was the decider. And Obama is much more willing to change his mind and thumb his nose at expectations. And, I think that's fine when you support what he's doing. I wonder when their numbers start coming down if that's going to still sit as well with people.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think it would take for those numbers to start coming down? The economy again?
Yeah, the economy, or North Korea and Iran are, are very pressing issues right now. If the administration felt they had to do something, go in there and do something, that would probably bring his numbers down. If this economy doesn't improve pretty soon, and now what we're looking at in his budget, funding this health care program that he wants to do, if taxes go up.
Mm-hmm.
Those would all be things that I think would bring his numbers down, mm-hmm. and then would erode sort of very strong public support for his policies and what he's trying to do.
There's another huge issue that I would imagine there will be some movement on in the not too distant future, and that's healthcare.
Healthcare, it's huge.
It is huge.
Yeah, it's huge, and he's put forth this notion, but not really devised a way to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the process. You know, he'll put out this idea and then have Congress come back with ideas to pay for it, and then it makes them stakeholders in the process, and it gives them an investment in making it happen. But they can't figure out any way that's sort of politically palatable to pay for, you know, expanding health care to people. There's some options on the table that people are not going to like. Taxing health benefits, the benefits that we get from our employers, some of us, most of us, are not taxed as income, and they would be under one proposal that's being floated. Also, they're talking about taxing sugary soft drinks and sugary iced teas. Also, they would tax maybe some nonprofit hospitals that aren't doing enough. That wouldn't generate as much revenue, but they could also tax alcohol and tobacco more. So these are all things that, you know, have very strong lobbying interests in Washington. So those would all be terrible fights. Hmm.
Sugary soft drinks, but not non-sugary soft drinks?
No, not sugary soft drinks.
It would be sugary soft drinks. I didn't know that. Thanks, Zach, for your call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join us. Julie Mason is our guest for All Things Political, and the number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and Stephen from Fish Creek is next. Hi, Stephen. Sorry, there we go.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
I'm kind of troubled. I guess I don't know exactly what to think about the rage that I see about this doctor being murdered, and I guess what I'm wondering is there any empathy for the people who felt so passionate about the fact that this doctor, nonetheless, whether it's legal or not, wherever we draw the line in the sand and say an abortion is legal here, but then the next day it's not legal because it's too many days have elapsed. So it's really a made-up reality that we've decided on. Here it's murder and here it's not. But some people see it differently. They see the line in the sand in a different place, at the like way at the beginning. And, you know, when those people become so passionate that they take, someone finally can't stand it and takes action, I just takes a law into their own hands, breaks the law, commits a murder because they're so driven. I wonder if there's any point where anybody on the left can understand what that must feel like. And I wonder if there's anybody that has, you know, any kind of sympathy or compassion for the people who really seem to be so completely concerned about a continuing loss of life through, I know I'm speaking to two women, you know, through something that might take away your rights to make decisions about your own body. And, you know, I guess I want to hear some dialogue about that because it's bothering me. I see people so angry about this, like, you've done, wow, look at what the conservatives have done. It's like some kind of a crime has been committed by a whole group of people because they believe that this was okay, you know, or much worse, that they're celebrating it, you know. So anyway, I'll get off the phone and just listen to this.
All right, thanks for the call.
Yeah, President Obama called it a heinous act, mm-hmm. but the abortion debate is something he has not wanted to get into at all. I mean, talk about an intractable issue that just divides and divides. There's no middle ground.
Yeah, but he has not been afraid to address it, at least address the divide, as he did at Notre Dame, right? And to address it in terms of this was a heinous act, it was a murder.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, but he is not trying to do any sort of policy making on this issue at all. He has said that he supports a women's right, but he wishes there were fewer abortions, which has become really for Democrats the safe place to stand.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I understand from watching the news on this over the weekend, this is not something that those who believe that abortion is a terrible thing, they were pretty across the board condemning the action of this guy who killed somebody
right.
in
well,
a church.
Certainly, there's a fear on the side on the rights movement, on the pro-life movement, that this will set back their cause. That it will it inflames the pro-choice movement and makes the pro-life movement look fanatical, mm-hmm. which it is not. It is, you know, it is as with any issue made up of people who feel very strongly, but are reasoned. They're not, you know, murderers,
right?
So they're afraid that this will be a setback for that effort, and at least so.
Yeah, sure. Julie Mason, our guest, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 1st of June. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Julie Mason, our guest. We go back to phone calls now. And Sam from Menominee. Hello, Sam. Hi, Sam.
Hi. I was just wanted to talk about the administration and how it promised it would pick up the economy and it's not doing its job. I mean, I can see the first 100 days, but I mean, it's way past 100 days. And I would never vote for Mr. Obama again if this goes on.
Right. It's quite a conundrum for a president because here he is out on a limb spending $787 billion on the stimulus plan. And, yeah, I think people really want to see results. He's begging for patience. But it's, you know, as the caller indicated, I think patience is wearing thin. People lose their jobs. Families are in terrible straits. People losing their retirement savings. I think a lot of people did expect quick results.
Mm-hmm. Which can't happen. I mean, it can't happen quite that quickly. We're a society that wants everything to happen in the last moment. And
right. We're instant gratificationists.
We sure are.
For sure. But yeah. This economy, it's going to take a while. And you hear all sorts of different predictions from economists. I think it's like predicting the weather on when it's going to improve. Boy, the Obama administration really wants to show some improvement sooner rather than later. But circumstances will go as they will. And like the caller said, you know, the results have been slow in coming.
Right. Thanks, Sam, for the call. We go to, is it Sharon from Duluth?
Sharon.
Oh, it's Sharon. Hi, Sharon.
As far as the economy, I mean, the fact that it took us 8-10 years to get here makes me think this is nothing that's going to happen overnight by any means. Mm-hmm. Most of the economists that I've heard on public radio and television are talking years here. I called about health care, however. I am disappointed that Obama is not taking the lead on the idea of the single payer. And Moyer's Journal had an excellent presentation this the weekend before last. If people are interested, they can probably find it online. And pretty much made a real good case based on figures from the Office of Budget and Management. I think that's the name of it anyway. A pretty legitimate source that we could have health care for pretty much everybody in the country without raising the cost at this current time. And that would be the amount of taxes that would be needed to be paid by the public would offset the kinds of premiums and co-pays and so forth that we're having. And again, this was an excellent explanation of how we could get there. And it's doable. And these people have been working on it for years. So when people talk about the concern of, you know, taxes getting raised and so forth, think about what we are paying, those of us that have a health insurance, for that insurance and for our co-pays and so forth. But my disappointment is that the only way it's going to happen is if it has strong support from the president and from the leaders in the Democratic Congress. And the biggest stumbling block seems to be the effect that all this money from the insurance and pharmaceutical companies has on Congress. And so I think the public really needs to get in touch with everybody that they think and have some influence here and promote that we want to hear about this. It's being shut out of the conversations in most of the hearings.
Julie.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's an option you don't hear about that much. Obama had backed away from universal health care, and he really didn't want to fashion a plan and then send that over to Congress. He wanted to create a concept, you know, expanding healthcare, making it affordable for everyone, and then send it over to Congress to figure out how to do it. And Congress has never had a great, strong political will, and they don't have a strong political will for this. They're going to, I suspect, take a path of least resistance. And as the caller correctly noted, there's the incredibly strong influence of the healthcare industry is bringing all its forces to bear on this debate. And so I think, I fear that what we're going to end up with is not a revolutionary policy or anything dramatic, but something that both sides can live with, and it'll end up being some sort of compromise agreement that will be fashioned with the very strong input of the industry, and it's not going to look like single payer.
And would he be able to accomplish simply, I keep thinking, because businesses have had a great, have had problems with being able to pay for premiums. Everybody's premiums are going up. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got a number of people who don't have insurance, and that keeps going up. Would the public buy some kind of radical change here to our healthcare system? Is the time ripe for that, do you think, Julie, or not?
You know, I couldn't say what the public would buy. I'm not really sure. I don't think this is a big priority for a lot of people. I think it's a second or third priority. People are concerned about themselves. I know a lot of people lack health insurance and want an affordable option. But what form that option takes, I think, is, you know, as long as they can get health care and it's affordable, I think that's where the concern really stops and ends. But if people are concerned, they really should get in touch with their member of Congress and make themselves heard on the issue, because that's what moves opinion. It really does. It really can have an impact when people contact their members of Congress.
Sure.
They really listen.
Thanks, Sharon, for your call. Pat from Menominee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Back to the economy. You know, I was going rewinding back to my memory, and to me, when the economy started to take a nosedive was when we saw oil prices start to climb through the roof. And I can remember in one particular press conference, one reporter went and asked President Bush, experts are predicting that gas is going to go to $4 a gallon, you know, and he said, I didn't hear that. And boy, I tell you what, it just went through the roof.
Right.
Well, oil's now $67 a barrel, almost $3 a gallon here in Menominee. We're in the middle of the summer. And I don't see the press, and I don't hear anybody stomping their feet to the Obama administration saying, hey, wait a minute, what, you know, when you were running for president, one of your biggest themes was is that, you know, we need to get energy under control, we need to control these oil prices, and if there's anything that's going to choke off this recovery, it's going to be people not being able to take a vacation, you know, they can't drive their, can't go camping, can't run the boat, so forth. But I don't hear the press or anybody going to the Obama administration now saying, hey, look, gas prices are doing it. You know, it's, the writing is on the wall.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, energy is a big part of what he's trying to do. They've made a big investment in the stimulus bill in development of alternative fuels. And, you know, that's just a really slow time in coming. But then we also see in these automotive industry interventions that they're doing, requiring these automakers to develop more fuel-efficient cars. So that's something they're also doing. But you're right, yeah, gas prices are going back up, and where's the urgency that we saw? What was that last summer and the summer before? You know, they won't deal with it until it's a crisis, and it won't become an immediate issue until it's a crisis. So when it's just sort of ominous, it becomes a sub rosa issue, and it's not a priority. But I think if those gas prices go up, you'll start hearing more about it, and indeed, as we get into the summer holiday season. It's a really good point.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Fred from Palmyra, hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have a comment that'll come as a question, and then another quick question. How can anybody expect one man to solve these problems that we have with the economy, inflation, and such? And the other question is that about Paul Ryan, who's the darling of the new conservative movement, who says his mentors are Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, who wrote The Road to Serfdom, and there's this Atlas Society that was also mentioned in a newspaper article I read about them. What do you know about this Atlas Society?
I really don't know much about them at all. I'm sorry. I'm not familiar with the workings of Mr. Ryan, so Sorry, I can't help you there.
But what about the first part, that it's really too much to ask? And there's also been criticism that the president has taken on too much, but too much to ask one person to change these many, many problems.
Well, he ran on a promise that he could fix it.
Mm-hmm.
So he really can't now claim that, oh, I can't do it. And it's not one man. He has a massive administration and many, many people working with him, and they're experts. And they are at work on this issue. He had some ideas on how it could be fixed. And I do think we need to give some time for his policies to show some results before we start judging. I may sound critical, and I am critical, but I do think there hasn't been enough time to see if his policies result in a turnaround in this economy. I'm not sure when that time comes, maybe at the end of a year, maybe at the end of 2 years. The economy is its own thing, and there's not really much that presidents can do. But once you start spending $787 billion, you better show some results.
That's a lot of money, isn't it, Julie?
Yeah.
I know, and it's our money.
Yeah, it's our money.
Our money. So something needs to happen. Well, Julie, thank you very, very much for being with us.
Wow, the hour just flies by.
Yeah, it does. We have a good time. There's so much to cover. Thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, which is a fairly new job for her. We've interviewed Julie for a long time, and she for many years was covering the White House and national politics for the Houston Chronicle. Joined the Examiner as White House correspondent. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for doing on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up, and just a reminder that we talk politics, well, we always talk politics, but every Monday at 9, you can be sure that we'll have a great guest on talking about the politics of the upcoming week and also looking at what's happened over the weekend and the days right before the weekend. We do this every Monday at 9. News ahead, we'll return with another hour of Monday conversation, and it should be a good one. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.